Why me? The story goes that there was an Arabic man who helplessly wandered through the desert, and he was thoroughly lost, and he came upon a Jewish tie salesman. "Water, water," the Arabic man said. "I have no water, only ties," said the salesman. "Would you like to purchase a tie?" "No," the Arabic man said. "I need water. Tell me where there's water." "Are you sure you wouldn't like to buy a tie for me? I have many colors, and right now, if you buy two, you get a third one free." "No," said the man. "I need water." The salesman continued, "These are the very best ties you can buy, hand sewn of the finest silk." "No ties, only water. Where can I get water?" "Okay, I hear you. I know where there's water. 20 miles east of here, there is a village with an abundance of water." So the Arabic man stumbles off into the distance, and sure enough, he sees the village in the distance. And with the very last of his energy, he pulls himself up onto the steps of the most beautiful hotel.
"Water, please give me water."
The doorman says, "Water, why? We got lots of water. We got mineral water, soda water, even many flavored waters."
Just bring me plain old water."
"Oh, I wish I could," said the doorman, "but you got to have a tie to get served." Didn't see that coming, did you? Have you ever wanted something so bad that it consumes all your energy, consumes all your attention and all your resources? Like the man in the story, we've all sought refreshing water only to be denied and find that the well or the cistern has dried up. And further, like the salesman, our friends and family are offering suggestions and actions for us to take that really do nothing for our longing. Job enters chapters 27 and 28. With only really one unresolved question left. Despite his friend's hurtful words and lack of comfort, Job asks again and again throughout the book, why? His friends have insisted all along that all this terrible stuff happened to Job because he's an unrepentant sinner. But Job knows in his heart that that's not true. Now, chapter 28 is different from all the other chapters. Some scholars believe that it was a later inclusion, but it does still appear to be linked to chapter 27. You know, the three friends, despite their troubling presence, they were trying to teach Job something. But now Job turns the table and tries to teach them. Job challenges their arrogance of ever thinking that they could understand the wisdom of God. So in this 28th chapter is a beautiful poem about God's incredible wisdom. Finding and understanding God, Job compares to a mining operation. We are invited to consider what it entails to go and mine the good things, the precious things out of the ground. I don't know how many of you have been down in a mine, but a mine is a very dark place. Surprisingly, it's also a very warm place. I was surprised to hear that. It's a mysterious place. You don't know what's lurking down in the shadows. A mine is a place of loneliness, and it also is a place of potential suffering. You strike the earth at any given point, and you have no idea what you're going to find. But try we must to extract the precious bits that are hidden in the rocks. The only reason people go mining is in the hope that they will find something valuable. Thus, Job's anguished questions about why this is happening to him are kind of, in essence, an act of hope, just like a miner has every time they go down into a mine. Even the smallest bit of wisdom would be precious to Job right about now. Did you notice that other creatures in this world, like lions and falcons, they don't go mining. You notice that? They've flown over the riches. They've walked over the riches. But they don't really care that it's down below the ground. So we are invited to join the search for something that's of matchless value. I'm going to admit to you right off the bat that I don't know very much about the mining process. I really don't. I've always wondered how a prospector can look over a certain area and know where to look for the precious jewels or the gold or whatever. How they decide where to dig. How do they know how to process the ore, the raw material they get out of the ground into metal or gems? How do miners keep their sanity being so far down underground with only one way out often and the inherent dangers of mining? You know, the technology of today is vastly superior to that of Job's day. And this has led to deeper and richer discoveries of buried wealth under the earth. However, for Job, the question isn't about know-how, but rather why. So thus we finally begin to grasp Job's big point. All this talk about mining is really a metaphor for creation. God in his infinite wisdom has made the universe around us. In our human intellect, we are always therefore looking, searching for new understanding and new things all the time. I know this will be hard for you to handle, but there are a lot of things in this world I'll never understand. For a believer, we can observe the knowable universe. We can marvel at how intricate and beautiful it is. Humanity has been mining the secrets of this created universe for a long time now, but one thing is lacking. No matter how much we learn about anything, we cannot begin to grasp an answer to the question of why. Why is there a world? Why does the world work the way it does? Why am I in the world? This is the treasure that Job is trying to find. Everything else is like dross, the leftovers from the refining process. You know, jewels are beautiful, they're valuable, but for the most part, they're inaccessible to you and I. Wisdom is beautiful, it's priceless, but it's inaccessible, Job says. It's a bit of a catch-22 for Job and for all of us. Wisdom cannot be found, but it's so valuable, we have to find it. But it can't be found. We have to find it. But where shall wisdom be found, he said? Where is the place of understanding? The poem continues with a description of the absolute frustration of finding wisdom. There's no doubt in Job's mind that wisdom is of priceless value. We long to understand how the world works, and this is even more so for the one who is suffering like he is. Job is sure if he could just tap into this wisdom, the question of why would finally be answered. Job can finally say, figure out why he has suffered. And yet he also realizes you could take all the world's wealth and you couldn't even purchase a small portion of it, of that wisdom. You can go down into the deepest mine or the bottom of the deepest sea and still you'll not find it. If we search, we will ultimately fail. Even in the place of the dead, he says, that's Sheol, we will not find wisdom. So no matter our longing to find the answer of why, it will forever elude us. That's frustrating. It can be painful. So where then does this paths so passionately pursued by the world actually take us? It takes us right back to the ash heap, sitting on a pile of garbage, like Job was, screaming out the question, why? No living creature can find its answer. The very best we have will never achieve anything other than rumors or idle speculation. Since the very beginnings, men and women have wanted to find the source of wisdom. Do you remember in the book of Genesis how Adam and Eve longed for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil so they might become like God? Later on in Genesis, they built a tower to the heavens, Tower of Babel, so they might see the hidden things. And it all came to nothing. So why search? Why go to all this effort if it only leads ultimately to failure? Can you hear in these words Job's frustration, his heartache? These are things we too experience. If this poem ended here at verse 22, we might be tempted to just throw in the towel, to quit. To not only stop worrying about answers, but to simply stop trying to find meaning for our lives. We just quit, give up. And some people do come to that place, don't they? And maybe all of us at some point have been touched by such deep distress. Job, it seems, has ended up in this debate in a circular loop of paradoxes. But wait. There's more to that chapter, isn't there? Job has reminded us that finding wisdom is in many ways a fruitless task. But it can be a worthwhile endeavor if it leads us to one inescapable conclusion. If we cannot find wisdom, we can find the source of all wisdom. We may not know where wisdom is, but we can know the one who does know where it is. God alone knows the way, and this foreshadows God's speeches at the very end of the book. Like so much that we value in life, it is not what you know, but who you know. You know, no one in this room or anywhere knows everything. And generally, we distrust anyone who is a kind of a know-it-all. All through our lives, we've learned this lesson, but we don't apply it to our faith. If, as was in my case, I needed major heart surgery, I can go on the internet and I can learn all about it. I can find out why I needed it and what was happening. But you know what? It was still inadequate knowledge. I needed someone who knew the way. My doctor knew the way to healing. I don't know how to fix my car. Well, I know some things, I guess, but you know what? I know someone who does. Despite all the claims on the internet, I do not, nor should I, try to know everything, but rather to try and cultivate relationships with people who have the knowledge and the wisdom I need. Job uses the weather as an example, something that we all talk about. I actually heard someone once say that, you know, we all talk about the weather, but no one does anything about it. Wind, rain, lightning, thunder. Sometimes they destroy. Sometimes they bring life. Even today, with vast supercomputers and satellites, we still struggle to understand the weather. There's a wild, uncontrollable nature to the weather. And yet God gave the wind its weight, apportioned the water by measure, made a decree for the rain and made a way for the lightning and the thunder. The weather simply points out to us every day who really understands the universe. It isn't us. It's the one who made it. Wisdom is like the centerpiece of God's crown. So God speaks for the very first time since chapters 1 and 2, and it's the first time he speaks to humans. And he says to the man, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding." This is the most critical phrase perhaps in the whole book of Job. God directs our attention away from our agonizing questions towards himself. Stop obsessing about getting answers to your questions, Job is saying, and turn to God as the one you must seek. If you want to live in this world as a truly wise person, a person of understanding rather than a fool, do not seek wisdom for wisdom's sake, as it will puff you up as a know-it-all. Do not seek wisdom, seek God. This is very humbling. Neither the marvels of human technology nor the insights of human philosophy yield the ultimate goal to us, the theory of everything. But those words are also reassuring. To turn away from evil is exactly what Job has been doing since the very beginning of the book. The whole heavenly courtroom knows this. Even the Satan acknowledged this. But now all of humanity knows that what Job was doing at the beginning of the book is what we all should be doing. We will not find wisdom, but we can worship the one who is wisdom. The search for wisdom is a waste of time unless it draws us to God. Seeking wisdom is an act of the intellect. Potentially it's an act of hubris, but seeking God is an act of faith and a life of hope. This is the struggle of the book of Job. It's the singular struggle of our lives. Can we live with the fact that for all our intellect, we will never find an answer to why? Job has now concluded after listening to his friends that in their trying to offer him everything, they've actually ended up offering him nothing. In urging Job to seek wisdom as an end in itself, they have inadvertently advised him to a form of idolatry. You know, placing something else that's less than God before God, that's idolatry. Paul Tillich, many years ago, theologian, made the point that the definition of idolatry in his mind was putting anything less than God before God. In days gone past, we think of idolatry as kind of like shrines of beasts and odd fanciful depictions of gods, like the golden calf in Exodus. Even today, there are millions of people who still worship at idols. Did you know that? It's called Hinduism. But for the most part, we think of idolatry as kind of a quaint and ancient practice. Practice superseded by what? Science, intellect, philosophical speculation. Science is a wonderful thing, don't get me wrong. It has given us some marvelous advances. But you know what? It can only take you so far. There are questions that will never be answered. And many things we thought were truth or facts may eventually be found to be wrong. But Christians are not above being idolatrous too. The Bible, that wonderful document or biblical scholarship, can become an end in itself and not the worship of God. Many well-meaning, faithful people believe wholeheartedly if only they read the Bible, all the wisdom of God would just pour into them. But even the Bible itself points to someone greater, more worthy of our devotion. Our ultimate call for you and I in life is not the pursuit of wisdom, as priceless as it may be, but rather to repentance and to the fear of God. This is to be our lifelong pursuit, according to Colossians 2:6. Jesus is the embodiment of wisdom, for John says the Word became flesh. The priceless treasure of wisdom is revealed in Christ's death and resurrection. And Job is slowly coming to the realization that all his terrible suffering and what he really needs are not answers. He needs relationship. A relationship with the only one that can make sense out of all this. He wants to know and be known by God. And boy, do we need to know the source of all things, you and I. Especially when we are just hanging on by a thread in our lives. You know, there's a famous story about the chess master Bobby Fischer. Unfortunately, I can't prove whether it's a true story or not, but it's a good story. Fischer is reported to have gone with a friend to see a movie called The Seventh Seal. And the plot of this classic film, directed by Ingmar Bergman, is about a medieval knight who engages in a chess match with death, or the evil one. Throughout the film, the two of these people make moves on each other on the chessboard. And as the movie comes to a climax, the Prince of Darkness makes a move and with great finality utters the words, "Checkmate." And the film comes to an end and the curtain comes down. According to the story, the chess master, Bobby Fischer, who was sitting in the audience, turned to his friend and in a very puzzled tone exclaimed, "Why is he giving up? The king has one more move. The king has one more magnificent move left that can turn the tide and win the game." Wow. What words for all of us to hear. This story, true or fictional, speaks to our heart's greatest need. Reassurance. It's what Job has been just longing for through all this. It's what we long for. To a parent whose child is hopelessly hooked on drugs, there is real hope in the message that the king has one more move. To a father whose daughter has been drawn into a life of sexual promiscuity and poor relationships, there is comfort in the words, "The king has one more move." To those who watch the news and see the events in the Ukraine and worry that there is no hope, there's no comfort for us, there is reassurance in the words, "The king has one more move." To a church family mired in discord, torn apart by tension, theological controversies, there is good news. The king has one more move. This is what Job is now beginning to see, that no matter how rough your life is or what you are dealing with, the king, the very embodiment of wisdom always, and I mean always, has one more move to make. Amen.